he will learn obedience, as Jesus did by means of the cross. Whereas there's a difference between killing and correcting. That is, Saul fell from disfavor and lost the kingdom. He was not simply disciplined, he was destroyed. Not so much inspired.
He was killed, right?
Okay, well, we'll start there tomorrow. David wanted to build a house for God. God said, no, but I'll build a house for you. And part of his promise was that one would arise. His kingdom, there would be no end. And what? Last time I prayed, sure mercy. In this context, what is the significance of the term sure mercies of David?
Surely goodness and mercy shall never
go. Well, what I wanted to turn my question to David and get to them. The point, the significance of the sure mercies is that when this one of the seed of David comes, that God would not revoke the blessing. He would not. Take away his kingdom, withdraw his mercies as he had from Saul. That's what it says. 2 Samuel 7. Before we move on, you have to understand this. What to pray. It's the formula, the sure mercies of David. 2 Samuel 7. Are you all awake this morning? Who? That's what we're doing in a shop for this whole mess. Awake? No, sleep or dream.
You said when the seed David comes from the Messiah, that God would not deal with the Messiah like he dealt with Saul?
Yes.
And what way?
This is 2 Samuel 7:15. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul when I removed him from before you. Verse 3. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So the point is that one of the characteristics, the promise in that context was that when this son of David comes, the messianic promise, that his kingdom would have no end. Saul's rule ended in humiliation, did it not? Okay. Your descendant comes, his reign will not end in humiliation. I will not withdraw my mercy from him as I did from Saul. Yes.
He's talking about Solomon?
No, I think not, yes.
I'm a
It's not exclusively.
I'm a sweet journey in town, tell me, as simply as possible. What are we talking about? I mean, are we talking, is this, from a dispossession viewpoint, is this the problem?
We saw how the phrase, the hope of Israel, was a sort of a formula among the Jews, which encompassed, which embraced the whole scenario of messianic prophecies, put them together and made the hope of Israel. And Paul said, I'm in chains for the hope of Israel. We talked about that. What I'm saying is that this phrase, the sure mercies of David, translated in various ways, was the same kind of thing. It became the name of a promise. In other words, it became the rubric under which the Jews spoke of the promise that of the restoration of the throne of David, the Davidic kingdom. Recall my long discussion of the fact that this was the golden age, the age when Israel stood out. Therefore, the age of future glory is spoken of in terms of the age of past glory. It will be a restoration in a spiritual sense of the throne of David, and specific promises were made. And this promise is called the sure mercies of David promise.
And that has to do with, as far as the Jews and the spiritual sense, with the physical restoration of David.
Well, that's a question. We're simply identifying the promise. What I'm saying is that Israel, the Jews, label this promise, the sure mercies of David promise, indicating, meaning that one would come of the seed of David, David's descendants, who would have a kingdom that would not end. And the indication, statement of its eternality was that God would not withdraw his, he would not revoke his mercies as he had from Saul. Understand? And this became the label, a label for the throne of David prophecies. Yes.
The Jews labeled it the sure mercies of David prophecies?
Yes.
Is that used in the Bible?
Yes. Let's look at Acts 13, 30 through 34 now. Following the same plan we did with Lo-Ami and with the Tabernacle of David, 2 Samuel 7, Acts 13, 30 through 34. I want us to see here a pattern developing. We see not only how specific prophecies, listen to me, we look at the book of Acts, how specific prophecies were cited as being fulfilled, but we also see how kinds of classes or genres of prophecy were seen to be fulfilled, whole classifications of prophecy. So the question is, was this to be fulfilled in a literal, a physical kingdom, in a literal throne in Jerusalem, a reestablishing of the Jewish nation, and all this ties together. Can you see that? All these land promises, the restoration promises, the return promises, all these tie together. How you look at one governs how you look at all of them. Now the sure mercies, that's Acts 13, 30 through 34. Paul's sermon. Let me pick it up in verse 30. But God raised him from the dead. And for many days he appeared to those who came with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, the very ones who are now his witnesses to the people. And we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers. Note this. What's he preaching on? Verse 30. God raising from the dead. We're announcing to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers. What promise? That God has fulfilled this promise to our children. Molly? He has fulfilled it. In that, he raised up Jesus. As it is also written in the second Psalm, Thou art my son, today have I begotten thee. Now listen to this. And as for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no more to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. See that? Therefore, he also says in another psalm, that will not allow thy holy one to undergo decay. For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay. But he whom God raised did not undergo decay. Now note this. You simply cannot miss this. He clearly states that God has fulfilled the sure mercies, the promise of the sure mercies of David. This has, look what it says, God has fulfilled this. He lists on the general, the kind of promises that God has fulfilled. In what? In the resurrection from the dead. In that he raised up Jesus. He's fulfilled these promises. What is it? The beginning of the Son, verse 34. And as for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no more to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David. Well, you see that? He cites this problem. The sure mercies of David is fulfilled, not in the second coming, but in the resurrection. Remember I said that the eschaton is primarily a revealing of that which is already true, already been done, basically? Well, here you have it. Now, by the way, the Jewish view and the dispensational view and most premillennial views is that the throne of David will be set up when?
At the Revelation.
At the second coming, at the revelation of Christ. Now, simply point out that he cites this as having been fulfilled in the resurrection. That the Scriptures teach us that the rule of Jesus at the right hand of the Father is the throne of David. And it fulfills that promise. And Paul says so, does he not? Very clear. By the way, he cites evidence for this. For David, after he served the purpose of God, verse 36, fell asleep, and he's in the grave. His body underwent decay, not so the Christ. Now flip back to Acts 2, the very first sermon, and I think it's significant one of the key first prophecies that Peter cites is the throne of David set of prophecies. Now look at verse 29. Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Now, what's the significance of saying that? David, I want to tell you all something. David's dead and he's still in the grave. His body is. Everybody says, yeah, I'm not for me that. Yeah, didn't you already know that? I mean, that's, thanks a lot, Pete. Anything else? Any other earth shakers? Any other great revelation to tell us? Those are very significant coins saying, you see, don't you, that David is still in the grave. His body is still in the grave. Verse 30, and so because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne. There's the promise. There it is. The sure mercies of David prophecy. What had the prophecy been? David, you cannot build a house for me, but while you sleep with the fathers, while you are in the grave, I will raise up one, and he will have a kingdom that will not end. And so because he was a prophet and so forth, verse 31, he looked ahead and spoke of what? Of the second coming of Christ. No, of the resurrection of Christ. That he was neither a man into Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up. You see, by the way, this is maybe a minor sub-point, Jews understood the sure mercies of David prophecy. That while David was still in the grave, that God would raise up one of his descendants, give him a kingdom that would never end. His mercies would not be revoked as they had been from Saul. Now, we read where Paul cites this specifically, explicitly, as saying this is fulfilled in the resurrection. I would point that Peter does exactly the same thing. He makes reference to it when he says, that within verse 30 with an oath that one of his descendants to see one of his descendants upon the throne. And we know he's referring to that prophecy because he makes a big point of saying, you see, don't you, that David is in his grave. Okay, he said this fulfills the prophecy.
David is in his grave, and this Jesus of Nazareth has come, and God raised him up. Eternality. Here you don't think, what was the contrast? David, you're going to die, and while even though you shall be physically dead, I will raise up one who will, in contrast, have a throne that will never end, implying eternality, does it not? Contrast. And so he makes a big point of this. So the significance of Peter saying, David is in his grave and his tomb is with us today, is in the fact that he is citing the specific fulfillment of the sure mercies of David promise, that while David is in the grave, God would put one on his throne of his seed and not withdraw his mercies from him. See that? But the question is, you understand the prophecy. That's the significance of Peter's reference to the graveyard. But the significant thing is that contrary to dispensational expectations, he, as Paul does, specifically applies it to the second coming, resurrection, not the second coming. You see, remember I said the fundamental question is, is the church the fulfillment of the messianic promise, messianic kingdom, or not? What about David's throne? Is David's throne occupied or is it not? Absolutely fundamental. That is a pivotal question. Is Jesus sitting on David's throne now, or shall he? Did he ascend to David's throne in the resurrection, or will he descend to David's throne in the revelation? You have that? Did he ascend to the throne, and either he is there now, or shall he descend to it? And my question is, what does the Bible say? Well, we can see the unanimity of interpretation, the application of this, and you see the importance of it in this very first sermon to the Jews. This is one of the primary prophecies to which Peter makes reference. This constitutes the hope of Israel.
So, and the sure mercy of David, he said it took its beginning at the resurrection and sent him to the throne in heaven. What about prior to that? It had no. He was just part of the Godhead and had nothing to do. It did not apply there.
Well, of course, if this is figurative language, it's called it's the right hand of the Father making intercession. This is just one of the metaphors or one of the figures used to describe the rule of Jesus and the Messianic Kingdom. One more text, Hebrews 1, 3 through 13. Do you understand this, what's going on here? You see, the sure mercies of David. You know the song I think I've mentioned before. Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Let earth receive her King. We sing that when? Christmas. But it was written about the second coming. You know that? What? That is, he shall become King. He shall set up David's throne in Jerusalem. Well, that's not what the beauty. By the way, you see, don't you, why dispensationalism to survive has to apply the scissors and paste and the other things. It has to rely on the Old Testament, because you sure would get out of the New Testament. Hebrews 1, 3 through 13. God, as you recall how Hebrews opened up, he has spoken to us through the Son in contrast with the prophets in the old days. And he talks about his power, his reign, set down, verse 3, at the right hand of the majesty on high. Having become much better than the angels, he has inherited a more excellent name than these. Or which the angels did he say, thou art my son. And, but of the Son, he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. Verse 8. And the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. So forth. I can't read the whole thing. The point is, although it does not mention the sure mercies of David in particular, the throne of David is prophecies are cited as fulfilled in the fact that he, after he had suffered, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high.
that's the point in the Hebrews 1 without doing an exegetical survey of it. You got that? Blessed Son, he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. And the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom.
You see, there's no good holding a spiritual, invisible kingdom in contempt, saying it's referring to a physical kingdom.
It says throne, it means throne.
Oh, what does it mean?
Yes, what kind of throne? Where?
Well, this is absolutely critical, as I've said, and we see here that Peter and Paul both cited
when speaking to the Jews.
Why? Well, this is on their mind. He says, look, here is this prophecy. Throne of David, sure mercies of David. Christ has fulfilled it. How? Rose from the dead, ascended to the right hand of the Father. He is now on the throne. So, as I said before, we see not only specific prophecies, but high category of prophecies are cited. By the way, nowhere in the New Testament is it ever suggested that the throne of David prophecy is fulfilled in the second coming. Absolute sign. The other hand, specifically, categorically, fulfilled the resurrection.
Two words in the nomination, or sure and mercy. I don't see how to understand.
Sure means unrevoked. You count, and it'll always be there. That is, this must be. Saul held it his favor, and the favor of God was revoked. It will not happen to the side. The idea being an eternal kingdom as opposed to a temporary kingdom.
Does that prophecy in the second thing or three of all solid? Because it says when he does all, that will correct the
law. I think not. And I think in a secondary way. This is kind of the formula that he will not fall into sin, and that sin will not destroy him and have Solomon. I mean, it had Saul.
What do you mean, or what is that?
Well, if it has, if this has reference to Christ, then again, this is a part of the general form of the general picture. And of course, Christ learned obedience through suffering. Christ endured the chastising of God. All men do. Well, regardless of the specific meaning of that, we see the general meaning in the citation by the inspired apostle Peter. Any questions on that? See, while we're looking at these key prophecies, the next one is the rod of iron, Psalm 2, 6 through 9. Now, this is a very, very important one. By the way, we'll look back to the Hebrew text on this one as well. The rod of iron. Look at verse 7. I will surely tell... Y'all with me? Psalm 2, 7. Psalm 2, 7. Messianic. I will surely tell the decree of the Lord. He said to me, thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as thy inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as thy possession. Thou shalt break them with the rod of iron. Thou shalt shatter them like earthenware. Now this is the famous rod of iron passage, and this was for the Jews, and is for the dispensationalists, and some premillennialists, is a sort of a very much used prophecy. One of the real problems that is raised by the Jewish dispensational scheme of interpretation is that it has Jesus, the Messiah, ruling the nations not through the persuasive call of love, but through the intimidating power of his presence. That is, his rule shall be in the millennium, pardon me, the rule of a rod of iron. That is, the nations have refused to bow the knee to the will of the Messiah before, but when he comes and sets up his throne, when he comes and takes his place on the throne of David, then he will wield the rod of iron. Then they're going to get it. Now, I would simply point out that this prophecy is cited in detail in Hebrews 1, which we just read. Let's look back at Hebrews 1 again. He cites it, does not cite the whole prophecy, but he cites the first part of it. For to which of the angels he say, thou art my son, today have begotten, he'll be a father, he shall be a son to me. And again, he cites this as the fulfillment of the event that took place when he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Now the let's also look at Revelation 25.
Pastor,
yes.
Where does it quote Psalms? Which part of the part that you just read? Is that the part?
Hebrews 1, 5. It's a citation of Psalm 2.
5, 5.
Hmm?
Hebrews 5, 5.
Yes. This is a key prophecy in the hope of Israel. The rod of iron is in the sight of fulfilled in the same way that the throne prophecies and the sure mercies prophecies are fulfilled. That is, in the resurrection and the present reign of Christ. Look at Revelation 25. Revelation.
There's no chapter.
Left out the chapter. God, I think I know what it is.
Writing your own chapters here?
He makes a reference to it. He makes a reference to it. He makes a reference to the psalm as being fulfilled about outside the whole thing. Yes, chapter 2. Thank you very large. That's what I said. This is a. Now listen to this. This is to the church in Thyatira. That was a rough outfit there. Nevertheless, what you have, which is much, hold fast until I come. And he who overcomes and who keeps my deeds until the end, to him will I give authority over the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of the potter are broken to pieces, as I also have received authority from my Father. And I will give him the morning star. Now, but what he's saying is, same thing to read Revelation 20. He who is faithful to the end, he's going to rule with me. They reign with Christ for 1,000 years. I'm going to share his victory. And he shall rule them. He shall, that they shall have a part in this rule with a rod of iron. Okay? Those who are faithful to the end, they shall share in this victory, in this rule with a rod of iron. As I also have received authority from my Father. Note this, not will receive, but, again, this same thing used does in Hebrews 1, does it not? I have received this.
I have, here's what he's saying. You be faithful to the end. I have received this, and you're going to have a share in it. You're going to have a part in it, if you're faithful. What have I received? This authority by which I rule with the rod of iron, and you shall share in this authority. You shall have a portion in this. Now, note this, in both cases, it fits. The resurrection of Christ, every time we look at these prophecies, they are cited as being fulfilled in the resurrection of Christ and his present reign over the church. And it is cited by Paul, by the way, also in Acts 13, 30-34. And we've already looked at that, the sure mercies of David, but he also cites the second Psalm. Again, makes reference to it, cites it as being fulfilled. When Peter and Paul, this was a part of the first part of the Psalm was sung by the early churches. They celebrated the release of Peter and John, Acts 4. Well, the only connection, in Revelation 2, is the only citation in which it refers possibly to the second coming, and he cites it as sharing in authority, as already said, which he has already received. I have received this. Now, why does he submit to the church? In what sense then? Now here we go. The scriptures are very clear. This psalm, the second psalm, the Rod of Iron Psalm, is referred to and cited on these occasions that I've listed, perhaps some others, but these are the primary ones. Each time is cited the same way, and is cited in the same way that the throne of David prophecies are cited. It's cited the same way that the sure mercies prophecy. It is cited in the same way the tabernacle of David, which shall not be torn down. Amos 9. Note this, you see the pattern developing? Every one of these key prophecies are cited as fulfilled. These prophecies which made up the hope of Israel are cited as fulfilled, and they find consistent fulfillment in the resurrection of Christ and his reign over the church. And there's never any exceptions to that. We would expect that, wouldn't we? Because they form a pattern, they form a mosaic, and how one is fulfilled, they're all fulfilled. And we find these particular citations. And the reason we find these very important prophecies cited, whether others are not in the New Testament, is because these were the key prophecies. Now, in what sense then, what is his rule? There's a question which we need to deal with. In what sense is his rule over the world a rod of iron rule? Present reign of Christ. In what sense is it a rod of iron? In which he shall break the nations all opposition to pieces as a potter breaks clay. The clay pot is marred.
Paul talks about how our enemies are not physical but spiritual. Because he's talking about the cross, he broke the enemy of he broke the power of Satan as with the rod of the cross broke it, like a potter breaks clay.
Put down spiritual forces. How about over?
Well.
Yeah.
Rules over the world to conquer the people of God.
Well, when is the shattering going to take place? It doesn't take place. Well, you see, remember I said, look at it. Remember I said that the second coming, the eschaton, is a revealing. That is Jesus. Does Jesus have the rod of iron, among other things, that he speaks absolute authority, right? Over heaven and earth. Of course, we know that Jesus, as you well know, it has absolute authority of everybody. Jesus is Lord of everybody, not just Lord of the Christians. The idea that Jesus is Lord of the Christians and not Lord of everybody else is pure baloney. He has all authority in heaven and earth that's been given to him. Jesus has just as much authority over the worst enemy of God that ever lived as he has over the best Christian who ever lived. The only difference is that one recognizes that authority and one is an outlaw. Right? You understand that? You cannot make Jesus your Lord. He was your Lord all along. You can either obey the law, obey the Lord, or disobey. But he's still the Lord. Now, and the rod of iron, the significance is this, as I understand it, in keeping with the spirit of these cited fulfillments. And that's this. It is a rod of iron in that his rule is absolute now, and it is universal, and its nature, the absolute authority of Christ, will be revealed, Father. It is not established in the second coming. It will be revealed in the second coming by the fact that everyone shall acknowledge that authority. And in the when he destroys the enemies of God in the second coming, it will simply be a manifestation of what was always true. Listen, the man who is outside of Christ is dead, dead before God. The fact that the sentence is carried out. Does not mean that it becomes that's when he died. He's already dead. Dead in trespasses and sins, Paul says. So that the rod of iron is seen not in. And note this. This know how this fits with theology. The beginning we said, and I repeat this. We said that sound eschatology will not violate sound theology, right? On the one hand, you have this concept of the rod of iron, where he has absolute authority over his friends as well as over his enemies. And the rod of iron, which we recognize by faith now. In other words, when I say Jesus rules with the rod of iron, he has absolute authority, right? And he has it now over everybody, over the Central Committee of the Communist Party, over everybody. But it is not revealed yet. We are sons of God, aren't we? But we don't look too much like it. The world looks at us and says, not very impressive much. But it has not been revealed yet. The unveiling has not taken place. So that many things will be unveiled in the eschaton. Our glory will be unveiled, and the absolute authority of Christ will be revealed. It's always been true. So it will be unveiled. Everybody will see it. And then the rod of iron, which has always existed, has always been there in the absolute authority of Christ, it will be revealed too, all everything else. And when Jesus destroys before him, as when Jesus as the righteous judge destroys before him all those who will not obey the gospel, then the rod of iron is revealed. But it's always been there. Jesus says, you'll have this authority. I have already received it. And this prophecy in the second psalm is cited as fulfilling the resurrection by Hebrews and Acts 13. Now, in opposition to that, it's kind of like, let me ask you that. That's how I understand the rod of iron, in light of how it is cited as being fulfilled. Now, does that violate sound biblical theology? Well, no, it's in harmony with it, I consider. Consider the alternative. The alternative picture is Jesus coming back to earth, and here's the world about like it is now. People doing their own thing, and unbelief, immorality. All of a sudden, what a show. Here comes Jesus back, and he goes to Jerusalem, and he sets up his throne in a building over there. Reverend W. Armstrong at his right hand, and Oral Roberts on his left. Anyway, he's over there ruling. And here's Joe Smith, I wonder why he's not in the head of Missouri. Here he is on earth. And so he sends out word. Shape up or else. Jesus sends out the word. Now before I tried to claim your hearts to the gospel, but you wouldn't have none of it. Now I claim your lives and your obedience because you have no choice. rod of iron. So not going away, but he sends out the word that unless you want to you come to fire on your front lawn, you better shape up. All the bars are closed, okay? We're closing all the bars, all the popples joints a lot. If we don't, he's going to really nail it to the wall. I mean, here's the first thing you got the world under intimidation. And that's it. You get a picture? That's exactly what this is going to be. All the criminals, abject fear. Why? Well, he's fearful. So then, so what do they do? Well, they're shaping up, they're obeying. The world becomes this paradise on earth, the lion lays down the lamb. And a more terrible catastrophe. And there he is, this rod of iron. That's a difficult theology. Well, when I heard this writer going in, when he started thinking about that, thinking how it violates biblical theology, like a blind dog in a meat house. I mean, just every detail, everywhere it violates biblical theology. Starting with the concept of salvation by faith. And just going in. And it gets worse from there. That is, if you're going to do that, why not do that before the cross? If you're going to do that, why not do that back in the Garden of Eden? They say, is that, by the way, that is utter blasphemy against the character of God. The doctrine of the God of love. He doesn't make it very clear. He's the one body serving him. But they love him. Right? Isn't that true? Is that biblical theology? God doesn't want any kids in his house to love him. Now can you imagine what would happen on South Orange Blossom Trail? Jesus took up shop in Jerusalem, did that work. That's part of him. But, okay, you're out of business. Turn to burn. You got this? All those sleaze merchants down there, they said, well, I guess we're going to have to talk to us before we go down. You can talk with people. But my eye doesn't that make you just love him? You imagine all these cruds down there running that kind of business, going in together and saying, well, I guess we're going to have to be respectful. Just in Marvin, I just love you. I just love you for that. Do men love God when he steps in and says, you simply must obey me? Men want. They hate him more than you can imagine. The very thing men hate about God. He steps in and says, look, I'm in charge. You get the picture? I mean the whole thing. Manifest it, sir. You simply have to, if you're going to be a dispensationalist and have that kind of view of God working with man, you simply have to discard the body of New Testament theology and social theology. It all goes out the window. That'd be like, well, what do you think of me? And by the blasting the character of God. What do you think of a father who a big stick without the neighborhood, rounds up all the kids he can see, brings them home, beating them all the way? Okay, sit down at the table here. Now we're going to have fellowship. You kid, you good at the bathroom? No, sit down and wait. Go later. Okay, now we're going to say, I love you, Daddy. All together now. One, two, three. I love you. Then you kid, speak up. Third to the end. Gets on his. I said, say, I love you. What do you think of a father like that? Well, he comes to the net and takes away the ha-ha haters. You get some guy like that. How many of you have lived in a house like that?